We're debuting a new feature on Eastern Standard. We're calling it Future Tense. Hosted by anthropologist and author Chris Begley, the focus is on our future in a post-pandemic world.
Today I'm talking with Bianca Spriggs, an award-winning poet from Kentucky, currently an assistant professor of English at Ohio University. Her forthcoming book of poems is titled We're Still Big Banging and will be out in 2021 with Shadeland House Modern Press. You can learn more about her other work at www.biancals.com. Hi, Bianca.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. So let's start by talking about where we are now in the middle of this pandemic. I wanted to ask you, beyond the obvious, what's changed?
For me, it's been observing people collectively working through kind of like the five stages of grief, you know, and it's very clear who has led maybe a little more of a carefree life and people who've sustained trauma before, and watching the patterns of folks who are immediately like, make the bad feelings go away, make it all go away. And then the folks who've been in therapy or have dealt with their demons from trauma before, you know, they're handling this very much aware of their triggers and coping mechanisms. And I find that those people are the ones who are employing strategies to stay afloat emotionally. So for me, it's been very interesting to watch the emotional development, you know, people's EQ sort of evolve on the spot because, you know, our emotions point to our boundaries. And there are some things that folks clearly haven't dealt with in terms of, you know, acknowledging that control is an illusion, you know, and there are people who've made peace with that and people who haven't. So that's been the most sort of fascinating part of it for me.
What are some of those triggers or boundaries?
Well, I mean, being told no, you can't have something, you know, you can't do something, you can't go somewhere. Folks who haven't heard no very often in their lives are sort of reverting, you know, in a very childish manner to reclaim some aspect of control. For people who've been, you know, for one, culturally and systemically oppressed their entire lives, you know, it's sort of like, okay, there's just another added dimension to this now, you know, unless we're being called in as an essential worker to go work for these people who are protesting in the streets because they want haircuts, you know. So I think that it has been interesting to watch some people start to take ownership of their psychological boundaries. They're acknowledging increasingly, listen, I'm having a bad quarantine day. I'm having a day today. And other people are becoming more respectful of that, of those boundaries, because they can empathize now and say, no, I get it. You know, it comes in waves. So how we're all sort of navigating, you know, those restrictions is, I mean, there's a myriad of ways. Some people are baking. Some people are working out in the yard. Some people like me are writing, or, you know, we all have our little hacks, and those are sort of surfacing right now.
Yeah. And of course, the difference between your situation now and before varies from person to person. You know, for instance, I'm in the house with my wife and three kids, and that was, you know, pretty much the default state before. So, you know, while things have changed, obviously there's some continuity there. For other people, it would be radically different.
Oh, definitely. I'm similar to you. I actually live by myself with two cats. So when people are asked, how you holding up? It's like, well, I wipe my groceries down now, you know, when they get delivered, not much has changed. But for people who were like ships passing the night with their spouses or children, I know, because you and I both work in universities, grown kids coming home all of a sudden, and having parents who are like, oh my God, like, what are you, creature? You know, people having to adapt to being confined in close quarters with folks, you know, it's probably feeling a little bit more cloistered than for others.
Well, let's talk about the future there. And I wanted to start with some of the work you've done that has a dystopian or apocalyptic theme. Can you tell me about a short story you wrote, The Adventures of Snow Black?
Sure. I wrote this story actually about a year ago. It was a name. I gave myself this name, Snow Black, because I'm getting to know nature very well. I live in rural Ohio now and have been for the last, you know, 2.5 years. And for me, this story was about intellectual foraging, but I'm very interested creatively and scholarly in terms of, you know, post-apocalyptic narratives. You know, we've talked about that before, but I'm here on my own with no family or networks or community that I'm used to relying on for stimulation. And so I've had to reboot my imagination and decide what I can live off of, what I can make new, and what I can do on my own without the collaborations and partnerships that I've become accustomed to. So this short story is a way of me intertwining, getting to know the flora and fauna around here in Appalachia that just shows up in your yard, you know, and introduces itself, and setting up these kind of boundaries between their space and my space, you know, and also becoming incredibly acquainted with solitude here in ways that I have never been before. It's kind of lonely at first, and now it's like, oh my God, I can hear myself think for the first time. So what folks are experiencing now, I've had a 2-year head start. So that was the premise of the story.
Could you read us a little bit of that?
Sure. I'll read you the first few paragraphs here. And it begins, the character's name is Corinne, and she's journaling her stay here in this sort of nondescript place. And her first entry starts with day 477. She writes, "Remember, no one's coming for you. You have to do these things on your own. No one's coming for you. No one's coming." Corinne remembered the first day she wrote it. She'd tripped and gotten herself stuck while foraging between a boulder and what was left of a basement for 2 days. When she finally managed to get out, her voice ragged from crying for help, covered in the ash and soot that constantly fell. When she finally wiggled her way out and limped back, having sacrificed some of her clothing and her pack, she didn't wipe any of the grime off. She didn't go for the peanut butter powder. She didn't even take a sip of water. She went straight to her little diary by her sleeping bag and took the pen, back then it was a pen, and wrote in big blocky letters, day 335, "No one is coming for you." And she wrote it every day since, and it kept her alive.
You know, now, of course, you wrote this before all of this started. Now you're living through a situation which will have some similarities, at least to the solitude. Are there some themes from that you would pull out as highlights or indicative of your experience now?
Yeah, I've been starting this little series called The Quarantine Diaries on Facebook, which are just really these funny little anecdotes, and sometimes they're sad observations or experiences I have with social distancing and also trying to keep my mind occupied and making up these little stories about the groundhog out back and, you know, but also not able to interact with the neighborhood girl down the street when she got a new puppy. I can't get close to her and just, you know, and I know her, you know what I mean? So it's weird, and having a little kid look at you kind of scared all of a sudden, like I'm not supposed to interact with this woman because she doesn't live in my house. You know, seeing that realization dawn on a kid's face is, you know, so chronicling those little moments and encounters has become a way for me to just kind of stay sane, like this is actually happening, because memory will make it fuzzy one day.
Yeah, that's certainly something I've noticed. These interactions are now, you know, fraught with peril in ways that they weren't before. And so your interaction with people is different. And, you know, that brings me to the last thing I wanted to ask you about, which is a vision for the future. You know, when I study how people and how societies have changed in the past, one of the things that comes up over and over again is this amazing resilience in the face of, you know, sometimes true catastrophe. Mm-hmm. And thinking about our future after this, what is your vision of that?
Oh, that's so interesting. Maybe tangentially related to your observation, I'm hoping that this sort of competitiveness that Americans are so prone to, kind of like colonialist mindset we've all inherited, that pull yourself up by your bootstraps and there is shame in asking for help and there's something wrong with you if you don't have something to show for yourself. I'm really hoping that we're done with that. We're done with that era, that it's okay to help one another. It's okay to ask for help. The new industries that are going to arise from this, some things will be salvaged, but they'll look different. The new career paths, the new options people will have for keeping themselves busy, for connecting with community. I'm hoping it will be with more dignity and respect for everybody's experience increasingly moving forward, because now we really are in this together, you know?
Yeah.
So that's my hope.
I share that hope. And I want to thank you for helping me by being my very first guest here on Future Tense.
Thank you. I'm honored. I appreciate it.